Your identity creation was limited to the people in your geographical physical proximity. Today, your identity creation is basically infinite to build up an infinite consumption potential. That's terrifying.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Famous Failures, where I interview the world's most interesting people about their failures and what they learned from them. My guest today is Kay Hee. Kay is the founder of Rad Reads, which is a community of 20,000 professionals seeking to re-examine their relationship to money, ambition, and ultimately themselves. Kay has been called Oprah for millennials by CNN and the Wall Street Guru by Bloomberg. He spent the first 15 years of his career in the financial services industry researching hedge fund investments. He was one of the youngest managing directors at BlackRock, which is a prestigious Wall Street investment firm, where he saw the New York research team. You can keep in touch with Kay and sign up for his newsletter, Rad Reads, at radreads.co. In the episode, Kay and I discuss lots of subjects. So we first talk about how Kay did the unthinkable and quit his job at BlackRock without a plan, how he coped with the self-doubt and the fear of failure in leaving a prestigious job and striking out on his own, what advice Kay would give to people contemplating a similar career transition. He also talks about what advice you should ignore, how he grew his newsletter from 0 to 16,000 subscribers, how you can stop caring about what other people think, what the scarcity mindset is, and why more isn't necessarily better. Before I play you the interview, if you'd like to keep in touch with me, your host, you can sign up for my weekly newsletter, The Weekly Contrarian, which goes out every Thursday, and it'll share with you an article that I wrote that week, along with recommendations on books I may have read, articles I may have enjoyed, tools that I use, really anything that helps challenge conventional wisdom and helps you look at the world a little bit differently. You can sign up for that by heading over to weeklycontrarian.com and dropping in your email address. If you sign up, you'll also get my free ebook, The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles for Innovating Your Thinking. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Kay Hee as much as I did. And thank you, as always, for listening. Kay, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ozan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me begin by giving a shout out to our mutual friend, Kristen Stone, who first introduced us, and she's the reason we ended up meeting in person in Arizona. So thank you so much, Kristen. So Kay, take us back to when you were 35. You were one of the youngest managing directors at BlackRock, which, for those who don't know, is a prestigious investment firm on Wall Street. You did the unthinkable and you quit your job without a plan. Can you walk us through your thought process and what happened?
I'll start with a brief history leading up to it. I was the child that basically used his allowance to buy SAT books. I knew about the track, whatever that means, but you could say the academic and the career track from a very, very young age. And we could talk about why a lot of it was motivated by fear and insecurity. But I got myself on the track thanks to work ethic and some amazing parenting. And it was going to Yale, computer science, and then Wall Street for 15 years. So I ended up a 35-year-old. I had been promoted to managing director. I was managing a team. I actually liked my job too. I didn't love it, but I liked it. Something started to gnaw at me probably 3 years into it. And it was a mix of, is this what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life? To questions about, what's the point of this work? I mean, I was helping global institutions make an extra 0.25%. I mean, that was value that me and my team were creating. And that combined with this kind of angst of having a one-year-old child and seeing the passage of time in a much crisper way just gave me this anxious feeling, this what am I doing with my life? And so I pulled the ripcord. I called up my boss and tendered my resignation with very, very little planning about what I was going to do subsequently.
Since the show is about failure, how did the fear of failure factor into your your decision to leave BlackRock? Because you're a rock star at your job and you quit at the top of your game. So you ended up transitioning from a position of success in a job that you liked to a position of potential failure.
I mean, there was so much going on in that whirlwind period, but I think I'd step it back to even identity before failure, meaning, like you said, rock star, I'm using giant air quotes there, but my identity was very, very well crafted after, you know, spending 20 years putting it together. I was a hard worker. I had a position of influence and power. I had autonomy and I had financial success. I had done well financially. To have all of those things ripped away from you was completely terrifying. You don't really anticipate the loss of identity. I didn't. So that was really, really destabilizing. But for me, the fear of failure was actually failing my family, right? My wife is our primary caretaker, and so she doesn't work. We had one kid at the time. We have two kids. And there's just almost the math of the question is, are you putting yourself in financial jeopardy? And will financial failure ruin, you know, what you've spent 20, 30 years building up? Or even worse, will it have a negative impact on the people that you care the most? And so to bring it back, there was the identity of not being any of these things that people expected of me and knew me to hold. And then there was the failure that was really driven by financial failure that I won't be able to figure this out. And then bad things will happen to our family financially.
I'm so glad you mentioned identity, because I think that's such a huge part of why people don't make the type of quantum leap transitions that you ended up making. Like, you tell yourself a story when you look in the mirror every morning about who you are and who you aren't and what you should do and what you shouldn't do. And, you know, it could be that you're a serious lawyer and serious lawyers don't quit their jobs to go teach yoga. Or in my case, it was, you know, you're a serious professor and serious professors don't blog or podcast for the general public. But it's only when you risk that identity that you can actually take a step forward. There's a poem I love from Donna Markova. She says, "I choose to risk my significance to live so that which came to me as seed goes to the next as blossom."
Oh, wow. That's beautiful.
Yeah. And I think that the idea of significance ties in nicely with identity as well. It's only when you risk your identity, what you've worked so hard to build, that you can actually transition to the next phase of your life.
And just on that identity, just to really bring it back viscerally, I remember two things that really shook me to their core, and they were so innocuous, but I would get all these texts from people that were just bewildered about my decision, mostly in the industry. The text would just say, "What are you doing now? ? And I've actually spoken to a bunch of people who have taken career changes or taken breaks. That is one of the scariest questions to answer, because we are in a society of hyperactive professionals. And I was, and to some extent still am, where if you're not growing, you're shrinking. If you're not doing, you're wasting away. If you're not pursuing that next dollar, something's wrong with you. And the way that that simple text, which would stir up all these feelings, was so, so, so visceral. And then there was another thing about identity, is that people would say, "So when is your vacation over?" And as an entrepreneur, you know, the entrepreneurs on the show, and you will know that entrepreneurship is not black and white. It's not working at 9 to 5 and being on vacation, and entrepreneurship kind of, it really blends into your life. And the thought that people would think that I was lazy, it almost like I wanted to raise my hand and say, "Don't you think that I'm lazy right now?" Because I'm not. And I would actually get defensive about it and say, "I've been doing," I had this one line. I said, "You know, I probably woke up earlier than you and went to sleep after you, working on blah, blah, blah," just to make myself feel okay with that loss of identity.
How did you deal with all that? So you've got the barrage of texts coming from your friends. What are you doing now? When is your vacation over? And then you also mentioned earlier about the fear of financial failure with respect to your family. How did you cope?
I'd separate those. With the financial failure, it was somewhat straightforward where I took a conservative estimate of 18 months of living expenses. And mind you, I had a kid and a family, so it was not the ramen eating expenses. It was kind of, if we kept our lifestyle the same, how much would we need to live for the next 18 months? And I did, you know, I put them in another bank account and I paid myself a salary to just kind of simulate the financial needs. And I was very, I made an angel investment in myself. So very high probability of it going to zero, but a slim chance of a spectacular return. And so that was the initial, that wasn't enough for the financial piece, but that was how I got started. In terms of the identity, and this ties back to what I said at the beginning, where I was an insecure and shy, awkward 12, 13 year old who never felt as if he belonged and was very afraid that he would never be loved by, you know, a spouse or a partner and basically die alone. I had never talked to anyone about how I felt. And I had been wearing this mask about what I, again, the mask of identity. And so I was really, really fortunate to have found a few teachers. Some people might call them life coaches. And I walked into the first meeting with my life coach. And I walked into a life coaching meeting thinking that I was going to become a better performer. Because that's what drew me to getting a life coach is, you'll be a better performer. I'm like, sold. And then I walked in and the coach looks at me and she goes, you're very afraid. And no one had ever said that to me. And the way she just kind of picked that up from, you know, apparently I was talking very fast. I think that's what I did for my whole life. But there was a fear there was a fearful energy that I was carrying. And so she, and since I've had a series of coaches, she was one that basically helped me A, discover what my identity was, and B, build it back up to a place that was intentional, right? I was an identity taker, right? Oh, you went to Yale, you're a Yale graduate. Oh, you worked on Wall Street, you're a Wall Street, you're a finance guy. And flip that into identity creation and building from first principles and things that are actually very simple, right? I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm a teacher, I'm a writer, I want to be mentally and spiritually and physically healthy. And remembering when all that external stimulus and you know, perceived criticism was pelted at you, to remember that you had built your identity up yourself.
I really like that distinction you just drew, Kay, between identity taker and identity creator. It's almost the image that popped into my mind right away was the image of a cover band, you know, playing somebody else's song. That's the identity taker versus the image of a singer, an artist who actually goes through the painstaking work of creating an original piece of music. And that could be the identity creator.
Our society too, in the field of law, in the field of academics, being an identity taker is just lazy. Many, many people would never be resigned to say, hey, I'm not a particularly fit person, so I'm never going to work out because that seems too much. Being an identity taker is saying, you know, I'm going to be a couch potato when it comes to my identity. Whatever is handed to me in front of me, I'm just going to take it and not question it. And it doesn't mean that it's easy, but neither is staying fit easy, and neither is keeping your mental acuity easy. But I think it's one of these practices that I wish, and even with a couple minutes a day, people could really make a big difference in how they perceive themselves.
For someone who's considering a similar career transition, so leaving whatever employment they might be in, risking their significance and identity, what's one piece of advice that you would give them? And also, what's one piece of advice they should ignore?
The piece of advice I would give them is don't quit your job. and I'll unpack that. I think I say that somewhat tongue in cheek, but when you quit your job, especially without a plan, you're throwing the identity questions, you're throwing the financial questions. There's even difficult questions with how you interact with your partner and your wife, because you've never spent so many hours together. It's basically taking all of the most difficult elements and putting them together at the same time and lighting a match. The other thing, and again, it requires a little bit of introspection, is, are you running away from something or are you running towards something? And if you're running away from something, if for some reason you've always had a bad boss and you want to run away and be your own boss, I would just encourage you to really question, because chances are if you're running away from something, the thing's still going to be there and it's probably actually something within you. And again, take the bad boss example, you might be a difficult person to manage. And there could be many reasons for that. And so if you're running away from something, I would really urge a high degree of caution. And then if you're running towards something, at some point, it's like jumping off a cliff in Jamaica, where you're standing there and you're thinking to yourself, this is a bad idea, this is a bad idea, this is bad. And so, then your legs just move and you're off and you're like, oh, well, I guess I did it. And I think when you find something that becomes kind of all consuming and you think about it all the time, I think that's when you know that you're probably running more towards something.
Those are great two pieces of advice. So one is to not quit your job. And then the other is to ask yourself whether you're running away from something, you're running towards something.
One thing that is near and dear to both of our hearts, because we're older millennials, I'm technically not a millennial, but I am such a big believer that there is so much technology available to try stuff basically for free. So basically it would be start pursuing your hobbies, because there's so many doors have been opened, whether you can make a Golden Globe winning movie with an iPhone, you know, you can create a number one platinum track with, you know, your laptop, you could get a book deal through Instagram. I would say that see if you can start planting those seeds. Take advantage of that. I mean, that's like free. When I was in financial industry in 2003, to set up an email server for the company I worked for cost $100,000 with $15,000 a year of maintenance, which was an HVAC to keep the room cold. Wow. Just so we could get 5 email addresses. And the thing was always down. That was 2003. It's a very different climate to start something in 2003 than it is in 2019. And so take advantage of it. And I think you'll also see how committed you are. Are you willing to wake up 30 minutes before work or stay up an hour later? Because that will help you gauge if you've got the pull.
So if you want to be a writer, get up half an hour early and start writing. Mm-hmm. Come home from work and start writing, which again goes back to the advice you gave before about not quitting your job. And if you can pull that off, and there's so many stories of writers doing that and succeeding at it. And if you can pull that off, and if you actually enjoy what you're doing, then that might be the right thing for you.
And there's something special too about doing that. And you and I have talked about this offline, where when you're doing that, you're truly a hobbyist. As much as I'd love to say that I'm a hobbyist now, I gotta make money. And it's not a bad thing, and I'm not woe is me-ing it, but there's something about that kind of, you just do it because it's fun. And that tips over when you have to, you know, the M word, monetization. And that's something that I have a childlike yearning for from time to time.
So what's one piece of advice that they should ignore? So someone considering a career transition, any piece of advice that you hear, piece of conventional wisdom that they should ignore?
If you build yourself some kind of model that attempts to kind of map out your life situation, that tries to anticipate expenses and so on, I think that the model, life is too complicated to be distilled into a model, let alone a financial model. I think it's very helpful to think about edge cases in your personal finances, especially if you have a family. But to believe that you can put in numbers in a few cells and have the confidence that, like, this is the time to do it, I think it is misleading. It underestimates the emotional component of it, and then it overestimates the confidence that you might get from the result. So be careful about that. And I think I saw this a lot on Wall Street, where people would say, well, once I have X in the bank, then I'll do it. But the thing is, X was always changing as well. So I think attaching to numbers is always a very easy thing to do. But in practice, it actually becomes very difficult and unrealistic.
Makes sense. So what happened after you quit BlackRock?
I quit BlackRock. I had a one-year-old, and I had started working since I was 14, building web pages in the summers for the local florist. I had never taken 2 weeks off in a row, except for my honeymoon and the time between one job change. I had taken vacation, but never 2 weeks off in a row. And so we had this pent up desire to travel, and we did a family version of Eat, Pray, Love. My wife and my one-year-old at the time for 4 months across Asia. And we even cliched went to Bali and Ubud, where Julia Roberts is journaling and doing yoga. we did the family version of that. And I came back 4 months after. And that was actually a form of escapism too, because I didn't want to tell people that I didn't know what I was doing. And then we came back, and that was when all the text messages started coming, and the identity felt so threatened that I almost went back to an old vestige of identity. I actually almost started a venture fund because it was very clean. It was, okay, I'm a finance guy who likes technology, so I'm going to start a venture fund, and it has the possibility of making a lot of money. Now, guys, please stop asking me what I'm doing next. Here is your answer. And I started briefly down that path, and it had me meeting people from my old world, and I had cracked myself open just enough to say, I don't fucking want to do this. Yeah. This is just lipstick on a pig, and I am done with the pig. and so that was about six, the whole travel plus the flirtation with VC, that was 6 months. So I had about 12 months of savings. But again, this is where the model breaks down. The stock market had actually done really well, so maybe I had a little bit more. But again, if the opposite had happened, I don't know how I would have reacted at that specific moment. But I had about 12 months, and I just sat in an office. I got a WeWork, and I was ready to do stuff. I just didn't know what. So I sat in an office, and I just said, I'm going to work on projects that I find fun until the money runs out and see what happens.
And that's when you decided to start RadReads?
Yes and no. So RadReads, for your readers, originally just started as a curated list of 5 links, which, by the way, everyone has that now. But in 2014, when I was actually still at BlackRock, proof is in the pudding, I was trying things out while I was working. But in 2014, it was a little bit unique. Not every single Axios didn't exist and didn't have, you know, 19 daily newsletters. And so I had this newsletter that was just 5 interesting links with a little tiny bit of commentary. So it started while I was working, and I kept it up while I was traveling and figuring stuff out. And so I sat in this new WeWork. I was paying, I mean, WeWork's cost a fortune. I was sitting at this WeWork with negative cash flow. And I said to myself, well, people like this newsletter. It probably had 500 subscribers at the time. It was still in my Gmail. And I'm going to just make it better. So I learned how to use Sketch, and I made a little logo. Then I bought the domain and set up a landing page. And then I moved it over to MailChimp. And so it was just kind of playing around the margins with that. But it really kept me busy. You know, you would think that curating an email newsletter is just you read and you write. But there's actually this whole web of interconnected activities ranging from design to server management to social media to copywriting. And that's been the most amazing part of entrepreneurship to me, is that some of those things I find really annoying, like social media, and some of them I find remarkably interesting, like copywriting or design or typography, photography. And so every little side tangential project for the newsletter, I would just, because I had the freedom and the luxury of time, I would just go down and I would make it a little bit better. And that's how I kept myself busy.
And making it a little bit better, after several years, your newsletter went from 500 people to now over 16,000. Is that right?
That is right. And I think in that year, so this was about 6 to 7 months after I left. And I have to point out, there was one additional change there that's relevant to the story. So I had this email newsletter, and I had never written an original blog post. I was scared. And part of it was the identity. I didn't want to put myself out there. You know, I'm turning 40. So I'm still, sometimes I'm like, oh, the internet's so permanent. I started a blog to kind of go alongside the newsletter. And the premise of the blog was very simple. You know, Warren Buffett calls it the birthright lottery. I won the birth lottery. I came from, you know, a well-to-do family who paid for my college with no student debt. I'm an Asian male who's rarely been discriminated against. And then I had this great career on Wall Street. But I'm not the happiest man. In fact, I'm pretty miserable sometimes. And here's how it shows up. I snap at my kids because I always feel like they're bothering me. My wife and I have built up resentment because we haven't figured out the gender, you know, the parenting roles in this new paradigm. I'm always on my phone. I'm scared that I'm going to be broke. You know, people on Wall Street are laughing at me and they think that I'm lazy. And oh, by the way, I took all this time off and I don't know what I want to fucking do now. And so I kind of just started writing that. And that was, at first, people kind of scratched their heads and they said, is this guy crazy? Especially on Wall Street. You don't say those things on Wall Street because that's not the archetype that thrives on Wall Street. So I think there was some palace intrigue there. I'm like, why is he doing this? But I can't stop watching this slow moving train wreck. But within a couple of weeks, I started to get emails from people saying, I don't know why you're doing this, but you have verbalized thoughts that I didn't even know I had. And these are 60-year-old men to 16-year-old high school kids. It just kind of hit me. It was kind of my product market fit moment, to be so cliched. It was like, holy fuck, I'm not the only person that feels this way. Because to that date, I literally thought I was the only person that felt that way. And so I'll just accelerate the story really quickly. From the newsletter, from the blog, things went gangbusters. And very specifically, I got covered by Bloomberg and CNN.
And let me just underscore what you said, Kay. I'm a reader of your newsletter, and it's one of the emails that I really just reread each week. And I'm normally extremely liberal with the unsubscribe button. So that's saying something. And I'll include in the show notes a link to sign up to your newsletter. But one of the things I enjoy about it is because of how raw and honest you are with what you write. There's so much of what you see online is just curated bullshit these days, and your personality really comes through in the articles that you write and in your newsletter, which, you know, I think explains the growth that you achieved and the press coverage you got for what you're doing.
Thank you. That means a lot coming from a very, very skilled and discerning writer and a lawyer too.
Yes, lawyers tend to see the negative in everything. So now, one of the early topics that resonated with your audience was, how do you stop caring about what other people think? And you do some coaching right now as well, and I'm sure that's a topic that comes up in your coaching conversations. What advice do you give to people?
I ask them to come up with some values around, like, what does success mean to you? Some values or some statement. I call it a success statement. And, you know, there are many ways to get people to answer that question. You know, values and statements are a little bit tricky at times. But a reverse way to get into it is by asking people, if you won the lottery, how would you spend the next 5 years of your life? It takes out the identity question because you're rich.
Like, right.
People think rich people don't worry about their identities. It's not true, but at least you take it out for purposes of the example. You take out the fear and the real pressure and sometimes imagined pressure of finances, and then you get people to actually think about the things that bring them joy. And so you also introduce this element of time. What's your relationship with time? So for example, even if you were a billionaire, you still might have two kids of school age. So sure, you could fly all around the world, but your kids are either going to school and you're going without them, or you're homeschooling them, which, you know, has its own set of circumstances. I really try to remove people from those kind of exogenous pressures and expectations. And then it kind of, from there, you'll hear things like, oh, you know, something I would do if I had more time was be more vocal about gender inequality. Or some other things that people say is, I don't want to be rushed. I hate feeling rushed. And so you get this wide mishmash of kind of states of minds and states of being. And from there, you can then use that to redefine it as a building block. So for example, for me, I am at the point in my career, I've been out of the industry long enough where the people that I trained are now making more money than I made while I was there. Like the people that I recruited out of college. That still upsets me when I find that out. When I hear that this young analyst bought a Range Rover, I'm like, wait a minute, he was a little dipshit when I hired him, and he's buying a $100,000 car. What am I doing? But then I quickly go back to mine. And so for me, it's I value flexibility to spend a lot of time with my young kids and family. I want to be able to teach and be in service to others. I want to never feel rushed and not be wedded to a technological device. And I want to be able to have a healthy mind, body, and spirit. And I can either spend money for that or I can remove things from my life. And so when I feel these pangs of anxiety, I always go back to that and say, and I haven't achieved all of those things, but I know that those things, even if you gave me $1 billion, those are the things that I would want. And then it quickly kind of recenters me, it recenters us into the kind of an identity built up from the bottoms up.
That's such great advice. And I think the problem is, you know, most of us don't take the time to ask ourselves those questions. It goes back to the distinction you drew earlier between identity taker and identity creator. We're too busy operating on autopilot, sort of living this identity or living out the story that, frankly, other people wrote for us, as opposed to sitting down and writing our own story. And that, you know, involves, of course, identifying these values that you mentioned and not necessarily sort of going from one thing to the next without questioning whether or not what you're doing is consistent with how you want to be living your life.
And I would say people might be hearing this and think that they've done something wrong. It's our society is really very much what have you done for me lately, right? It's human doings versus human beings. And look, I'm a very driven person, but I think the analogy to exercise is so spot on. If you never exercise and you just went on a 10 to 15 minute walk every day, your probability of bad things happening to you health-wise would plummet. You know, that would be the 80-20 rule of just taking a walk. And so, you know, what really drives me about Rad Reads is, can I give you, through storytelling, through research, through exercises, through courses, can I give you the equivalent of the 15 minute walk for your mind? And maybe we could work towards Ironman and so on, but but really let's all start at a place that is accessible to everyone, and you just need that kind of initial nudge.
And one of my personal favorite articles of yours is on the scarcity mindset. So what exactly is the scarcity mindset? Let's begin there, and then maybe we can take it in a different direction.
The scarcity mindset is a combination of two things. The first is the belief that there's never enough time. So there's never enough time. The bonus pool is never large enough. There's never enough opportunities. There's never enough love in the world. You can never have enough money. Your house can never be big enough. And so it's that constant feeling of not enough. That's one way it shows up. The other way it shows up is with the ways that our minds catastrophize, meaning you could have a big pitch and you just blow it. And you actually didn't blow it, but you think you blew it. And in your head, this spiral, this cascade of dominoes unfurls where you had the bad meeting, your boss yells at you, you get fired, you're unemployed, your wife leaves you, you can't pay your cobra, and the next thing you know, you and your family are lying in a ditch. So that's the second way that it shows up. And the third way that it shows up is related to the two of them, is that it's a zero-sum view of the world, which is if one person is succeeding, it's coming at a potential cost of me not succeeding. And so it's very pernicious in Wall Street where you know, in Wall Street, you can buy a stock, which means someone sold it to you, and you could actually both make money over different time horizons if you're different investors. But it's this belief that like someone won and someone lost. And when you frame existence in that world, just a lot of bad shit happens. So that's what I would say is the kind of amalgamated definition of the scarcity mindset.
And I'm sure social media has exacerbated the scarcity mindset, you know, because this idea of a zero-sum view of the world, you're constantly comparing yourself to what other people are doing, how they're doing, how many followers they have on Instagram, how many likes they got on their latest Facebook post. And so that perpetuates the cycle of, I mean, if you were feeling not enough before when you were on your own devices, seeing how other people are doing, and especially seeing perfectly curated portrayals of a very flawed and imperfect life they're leading, is only going to exacerbate the I am not enough mindset.
Absolutely. And it comes back to identity creation, right? I mean, in the old days, and we're getting a little bit away from scarcity, but in the old days, your identity was I'm a Catholic, or I'm a union worker, or I'm so-and-so's son or daughter. And your identity creation was limited to the people in your geographical, physical proximity. Today, your identity creation is basically infinite to build up and infinite consumption potential. That's terrifying. That is really, really terrifying. And on top of that, so you feel the pressure to optimize it, but everyone has a slightly different interpretation of your identity. So it's really, really nerve-wracking. But that's the identity part. But we kind of walked away slightly from the scarcity thinking.
No, I think that was an important tangent because it does relate to the scarcity mindset. And one assumption, or I should say another assumption that underlies the mindset, is this idea that more is better. Right. So more money is better, more square footage in your home is better, more Instagram followers is better. But you've argued in one of your articles that more can actually be worse. How so?
I was with a friend. He's an older friend, and he was lamenting how he had bought a timeshare in a private jet, and it was bringing him a lot of stress. And so I know everyone's crying this man. Remember, but just hear out the story, because I think we all have a version of this. And so he wanted this jet share. And so he got this share where you get, you know, a couple hours every month. And so his month would come up towards the end, and he would realize that he hadn't used them, but he actually just wanted to stay at home and watch TV with his dog and order wings. Yet he then got on this jet, flew to Breckenridge, had incurred thousands of dollars of hotel expenses and the stress of kind of planning and dealing with all the logistics of that, and then came back, and all he could think of was he wished he had just stayed at home with his dog. We all have this version. I mean, how many times have I bought an iPad thinking that it will make me more creative? I think I have 9 creativity iPads. A friend of mine who's a great marketer, he said, so much of the things that we buy are material solutions to emotional problems. And so what is the emotional problem that leads to someone to buy a jet share? What is the emotional problem that leads me to buy an iPad every new release, even though I think it's kind of a worthless technology object? And so for me, in that case, it's a desire to be more creative. But I'm taking the lazy route by thinking I can just spend money. And oh, by the way, if you look at our house, I mean, here's another example. I use my Apple Watch as an alarm clock. And every time I'm like, where's that damn weird charger? And every time it's so annoyed that I haven't upgraded the software. I could buy a $9 alarm clock, but because I spent $600 on this watch, I have to justify using it. So those are a few examples. And I think an obvious one is more home square footage means the probability of more things going wrong. There's a joke that, you know, every time you call a handyman, it's $1,000. Right. So just increase that probability. And again, I think the question for all of these things is, why do you want more square footage? If it's an identity question, then you want to be the person with the biggest house amongst your college friends, then at least be honest with yourself. That will make the whole process more bearable. And of course, you're probably accountable to other people like spouses and kids and so on.
Those are such great examples. And let me add one, a recent example.
Yeah, I want to hear yours.
This isn't a personal one, but the one that popped to mind, you know, I mentioned like more social followers is better, but there was this recent story of someone on Instagram who has like, I think you mentioned this to me, Kay, yesterday, and then I read the article, but who has 2 million followers and she was able to sell only like 36 t-shirts to those followers.
Yep.
Which sort of, you know, again, underscores the point that having more Instagram followers doesn't necessarily mean that those followers are going to deliver on whatever outcome that you're trying to reach. And if you want to go back to something you just said, if you want more Instagram followers because you want people to perceive you as important, then that's fine, but at least be honest about it.
Exactly.
Because if you're honest about it, then you can then identify the underlying desire or the, as you said, the emotional problem, perhaps. It doesn't have to be a problem necessarily, but the desire that's leading to that particular want or more Instagram followers, as opposed to telling yourself a story about how more followers are going to support your business.
I had a post, probably one of my most viral posts, because it was somewhat controversial. And I had never had this happen where like people were just piling on in the comments. But because it was controversial, I started to get get attacked in my DMs. And I was just criticizing the financial independence, retire early movement, very gentle criticism. And people were just, I deleted the app from my phone, you know, as if it's like when all the pop-ups open up on your computer and you unplug it thinking it will make it stop. And I had this moment and I said, if getting more followers means being more controversial, I'm opting out. I don't want to live my life that way. It's not, nothing is worth it to me to have people just show up in my DMs and just be an asshole.
And I've definitely fallen victim to this idea of more followers is better too. I mean, I've been obsessed with, or I was, I'm still a work in progress with growing my email list. And one thing that I sort of didn't realize is now about 14,000 people is with growth also came this difficulty of identifying who my most loyal followers were. They sort of got lost in the mix because now you have this huge crowd and my email service doesn't make it easy to identify who the people are who are consistently opening my emails and engaging with what I write. And so now I find myself in this quandary and I'm thinking about launching this project to be able to discern who those people are, but more doesn't, and I have to constantly remind myself when I'm like instinctively checking my email numbers on ConvertKit or the traffic I'm getting on my website that like, where is this desire coming from? And is it actually going to get me to where I want to go?
I totally agree with you. On the other side of the equation, I would say it's okay. It's very human, right? So it's how do you, you know, I wouldn't want your listeners to take away and as soon as they start itching, you know, they get excited because they got a new follower that they start self-critiquing, right? It is a natural human tendency to want to be loved and to feel a sense of belonging, which I think a lot of these things are proxies for. But it really is, I view it as kind of gentle inquisitiveness, right? Yes. Gentle inquiry into the why.
That's the perfect note to wrap up this conversation on, Kay. This was so much fun. If people want to say hello to you, learn more about you, sign up for Rad Reads, where can they find you online?
they can come to RadReads, R-A-D-R-E-A-D-S .co. And the newsletter is kind of the hub for all the various activities, and you can sign up right on the homepage.
Excellent. And I will put the sign up link in the show notes as well. Kay, thank you again so much for your time.
Thank you, man.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening, and see you next time.